2095. Do we have a sign-up sheet for that one, Barry? I'd like to call up first Bob Gillespie.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Gillespie. I'm the administrator of the Housing Division for the Housing and Community Services Department. I've previously testified on this bill. I do believe that in that testimony I stated that the housing authorities are valuable partners and that we believe this bill allows them to be more effective partners to our department. I have reviewed the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. I agree with the language changes in those, particularly Dash 1, where we're eliminating the word slum and replacing it with blight. During the last hearing, I thought, as I was sitting here, I thought that would be a worthwhile change. And the Dash 2, I've also reviewed those, and I find no concerns from the department's point of view on that. I would like Paul Rennie to run through those, if we could, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And, that would basically conclude my comments, unless you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. Since the circulation of House Bill 2095, we have identified some additional areas of improvement to the legislation. Today, I'd like to speak in support of these amendments that capture those changes. The first amendment, the Dash 1s, at our previous public hearing, Representative Gerard correctly acknowledged the term slum was a negative connotation. In consultation with Oregon Housing Community Services and Representative Gerard, we propose using the term blighted area and replacing it for slum. So the Dash 1 amendments add in a definition for blighted area, remove the definition for slum, and then replace them throughout the statute. As a result, there's a few other statutes within the housing authority law that we added in simply to replace those terms. The additional issues that emerged are resolved in the Dash 2 amendments. In Central Oregon, a private company was capitalizing on the good name that one of our housing authorities had built up, the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authorities. And they were using that name to help sell mortgages. The Dash 2 amendments would add in Section 3, which would protect the housing authority's name so that it's used solely for the purposes of that local housing authority that's defined in statute. House Bill 2095 clarifies that housing authorities have the ability to establish limited liability partnerships, nonprofit corporations, and limited liability companies. The Dash 2 amendments will also add in Section 4 to amend the state tax code, ORS 307.092, to include these entities so that we may continue to use our property tax exemption as a means of keeping costs of affordable housing development low, focusing on low-income families. Then, given the recent closures we've seen due to manufactured home parks and the loss of affordability they represent, we were requested to add manufactured dwelling parks into the types of housing authorities can own. And this is done on page 2 of the legislation on the first line by adding in manufactured dwelling parks to the list of developments we currently have the ability to own. If the housing authority has the means and there's a need in the community, then we would hope to use this to help avert additional closures. So then finally, we wanted to clarify, as in our mission, the goal of housing authorities is to serve low-income Oregonians, and we wanted to make sure this was consistent in statute. Currently, there's some rent restrictions for when we finance mixed-income housing we need to meet, and we wanted to clarify that the other roles, such as developing, owning, operating a mixed-income project would also be included and be aimed at those rent restrictions so that the purpose is truly to serve low-income Oregonians. And this is accomplished on the last page in section 19 by simply adding those in. So that concludes my summary of significant changes in the amendments. In closing, this omnibus statute rewrite will help update the existing housing authority statute and enhance the tools we need to meet the changing demands in the affordable housing market. I'd ask that you adopt the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments and support the passage of House Bill 2095. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey.
So, and actually, I brought.
Okay. Chair White, members of the committee, my name is James Hackett, and I'm the director of the Lynn Benton Housing Authority, and I'm really here to answer any questions you have may have about the bill.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And anyone who can answer this, maybe it's a simple question. I'm wondering when you're describing on Section 4 on the Dash 2 Amendment, property of a partnership, nonprofit, corporation, or limited liability company. I noticed you distinguish a nonprofit corporation as being an entity, but the partnership and limited liability company aren't restricted to being nonprofit. So why is that not consistent, or why do you not allow regular corporations?
Chair Witt and Representative Holby, those entities that are listed there are the entities that are typically used in tax credit development, and they're the entities that investors prefer in order to get into it a partnership and receive the benefit of the tax credits back from that partnership. And typically it's a for-profit limited partnership, because we have a for-profit partner who's investing in order to get the benefit of those tax credits back out. So it typically isn't a nonprofit entity.
So I follow up, Mr. Please. Chair. Well, and I can appreciate that, but so that you're saying that would never happen in a corporate structure, that your corporate structure would always be nonprofit?
Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, housing authorities are public agencies. We're a public corporation. But we do enter into arrangements, become general partners of a partnership, become a manager of a LLC in order to further the purposes of providing affordable housing.
Okay. I think you clarified it for me.
Representative Dahlem.
Yes, Mr. Rainey, you and I talked about the rental associations. Have you been in contact with them in there? Are they aware of what we're doing with this legislation?
Yes, we have been in contact with them, and I think in meetings with each of the committee members, we've highlighted what those conversations have looked like.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else? No? Okay.
Chair Whitman, thank you. I just had a question about why you added the term manage to the list of being able to develop, own, operate. And I saw that in the amendments you had added manage, and I wondered if you could explain to the committee the importance of that.
Yeah, that was working with partners, John Van Lanningham with Legal Aid, who we work with, was looking at this. And in reviewing it, kind of a to clarify as one of the roles that housing authorities could be in, manage is a definition that could be used. So we wanted to be inclusive and make sure that for consistency, all the different roles that a housing authority could be involved in were included.
Not seeing any other questions. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. You vetted this in completely for the purpose of compliance with federal tax law.
Well, I'm not, Representative Barnhart, I'm not quite sure what part of the federal tax law you
mean. Let me ask it a different way, if I may.
Please.
Your capacity to offer tax credits is related to federal tax law.
Not sure what Representative Barnhart, that's correct. It's actually Section 42 of the Internal Revenue Code that allows our department to allocate federal tax credits to organizations, and then in order to receive those credits, they set up the LLCs so that it essentially creates an entity that can claim the credits. And for claiming those credits, they then put equity into the project up front.
Right. I understand all of that. And the question I have is, these expansions of authority that we're talking about in this bill or in these amendments have been vetted so that you're confident that they comply with the requirements of the federal tax law, so we don't put these credits at risk.
Chair Witt and Representative Barnhart, I can probably address that. We, members of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities, have spoken with tax counsel about this issue. And really, it arose because many of the investors prefer the LLC entity, and the way the statute is currently written, that's not an authorized entity for us to enter into. So that's why we pursued this, so that we could add that entity along with limited partnerships, because it's now being a preferred entity for the investor.
Right. Mr. Chair, if I may, yes. And you're giving me additional information that we had when we originally looked at the bill. I'm still asking the specific question as to whether or not you're confident that this bill does not affect the tax credits that are offered by the federal government. And the answer to that should be, yes, it does not affect them. If the answer is anything else, then we need to look at the bill some more.
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, the answer is yes, it does not affect them.
Thank you. That was the answer I was looking
for. I concur with that.
Yeah.
an
additional question.
Please, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm obtuse this morning. I don't mean to be. The other question I had was what effect on our own, on the finances of local jurisdictions that rely on property taxes will this expansion in the property tax exemption have? Do we know what the revenue impact on local entities will be of that change? And if so, what is it?
Representative Witt, Representative Barnhart, the really what we'd be doing is using the LLC as a method instead of a limited liability partnership. So we wouldn't expect to see a change in the amount of uses for that property tax exemption. We'd just be using a different vehicle to do what we can already, what we have the ability to do in statute.
I got it. Thank you. Just a quick follow-up.
Yes.
So this isn't really an expansion. It's simply a redefinition of the methods through which you can do what you're already doing in that area, and you're basically referring me back to the comments you made at our first hearing about that issue.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. And a follow-up on that, your answer in the affirmative that this comports with federal tax code, you have a relative certainty that this committee doesn't need to wait for any further in-depth examination of that tax code, that we would be on solid ground to move forward today should we choose to do so.
Chair Witt, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your explanation and description of the two amendments. Appreciate that. Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify today on House Bill 2095? We don't have anyone else signed up. Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2095 and open a work session on the same bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
I'd like to move the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Gerard moves the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2095. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any objection to the adoption of these two amendments? Thank you. They're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended?
As amended.
Thank you, Representative Gerard. Representative Gerard moves House Bill 2095 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Barry, would you please call the roll?
Could I ask one question before we make
a motion? Yes, please.
And it's my colleague, Representative Barnhart. There is no referral to Ways and Means. I'm not sure that I see an impact other than tax abatement. Is this something that should have a subsequent referral?
Ellen?
Thank you, Chair Witt. I did think and discuss that with other administrators, and the answer that I received was that because it does not appear to have a fiscal or revenue impact, that a subsequent referral is not required under the rules. I mean, obviously, you could make a motion to refer it, but under the rules, it does not appear that a subsequent referral is necessary.
And if I may, I had a similar thought about the possibility of referring it to revenue on the property tax issue, but the answer to my last question took care of that. In effect, we're not making a change in what we're already doing, except in form.
And I had a similar question as well earlier. So
I'm happy, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, sounds good. Further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Dowell?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lim?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the majority vote, House Bill 2095, as amended, is moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
I'd like to make a motion to put it on the consent agenda.
Is there any objection to placing this on the consent agenda? Seeing none, passed to the floor and placed on the consent agenda. Thank you.
And I appreciate that.
I was going to suggest, Mr. Chair, we
have a lot of business on the floor, and simple things that we can handle.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
This is when I go get a drink of water.
Okay, would now like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2540.
Very good.
Thank you. Yes. Ellen, if you would, please give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 2540 allows the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt a distinct building code for commercial or multifamily residential structures that are located in a vintage downtown district. And a vintage downtown district is defined as a downtown area that has been identified in official records prior to January 1st of 1950. It allows the director to waive certain building codes in creating this code, and it also allows the director to grant discretion to local authorities to waive further amendments, waive further portions of the code in their discretion.
And with that, I'd like to call up Mark Long from Building Codes Division, please.
Morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long, the administrator of the State Building Codes Division, and we're here just to provide you some technical background on these issues. They can be quite complicated, and just with a little bit of background, I spent the last 4 years as administrator working on regulatory streamlining, making sure that our folks get to yes on difficult projects and supporting flexible approaches to building codes. We're very supportive of historic areas and vintage downtown buildings. What I want to point out to you today is in current law, and I've just passed out a synopsis of the current law, we're allowed to accomplish what I believe is intended in House Bill 2540 already. And my concern is any confusing policy direction the legislature may send to us if the bill in its current form is passed. As you go through the bullet points that I provided for you, essentially the way it works for existing buildings is that local jurisdictions have the ability to adopt seismic standards themselves, use alternate methods for these existing buildings, and the fundamental piece of the building code is on existing buildings is make whatever additions you need to make, just make sure it's no more dangerous than the current situation. You don't have to bring it up to current code, and I think that there's some confusion in there. So that's basically the genesis of my comments. If you continue on down through the bullet points, we have the ability to adopt codes. We've provided direction to local jurisdictions that they can use the existing building codes that are out there in the community. One of them is particularly listed in the bill. That one's available. There are other models that we're currently evaluating that will go into effect in 2008. We think that that helps provide direction on this issue. And I guess before I close my remarks, and we've let the proponents know, the bill as drafted does have some awkward technical requirements in it, especially in Section 2, Subsection 3, and in Section 3. And I guess, Mr. Chair, I would let you know that if we were to do something like this, I probably wouldn't put the narrow definitions and the limitations of the 1950 in there, because if it's a 1951 downtown area, you might want to apply a more broadly standard. Those kinds of technical requirements in statute make me nervous, because it sounds good now, but in another 10 years or 5 years or 20 years, they become problematic, and we're back here telling you why we need to change narrower definitions in statute, how it doesn't apply to today's world. So, very clear, we don't want to send a mixed message that we're not supportive of vintage buildings and the desire to provide flexible approaches to existing buildings. I just don't want to make it worse now, and we believe local jurisdictions can already solve this problem. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. The question I have, and I know that you're kind of speaking in opposition of the bill, vintage downtown district, is that more or less the historical? There used to be a historical zone for a commercial, at least a while back, and so I'm kind of, and with those zonings, when a whole magnitude of trying to preserve the architecture of the building, some of them had, you had to use gyprock, or you had to use plaster and lath instead of gyprock, and there was just a whole menagerie of codes that probably weren't exactly doable, and I think that's probably the intent of this bill, is to address those sort of issues. Is that kind of what you see, or?
Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, if I understand the question correctly, my understanding of the way the code application works is there are specific provisions for designated historical buildings, and I don't know that that's what we're talking about here. For everything else, if you kind of go through our bullet points, on a case-by-case basis, the building official gets to provide discretion in how they apply the codes and doesn't necessarily have to upgrade these buildings, whether it's in a vintage area or in another area. It provides maximum flexibility on a case-by-case basis to deal with this, because it's difficult to have a one-size-fits-all approach. What I understand some of the concern is, and I've talked to others around, is that sometimes there's hesitance at the local level to provide that flexibility that the code suggests that you can. And if we need to do something at the state to encourage folks to do that or change our rules and regulations to let them know that, let local officials know that this is okay, I'd be happy to do it. If it's training, if it's communication, if it's changing in standards. My concern with this is we already do that. We do it on an ongoing basis. And this actually provides narrower requirements, as I see it, and may impact jurisdictions' ability to take that flexible approach.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you already do this in many instances. Can you provide us some outside of Portland where this actually has occurred?
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, I don't have it off the top of my head. I know we have a representative from the city of Eugene. I understand that they do it in their area. I've talked to other building officials anecdotally from Corvallis to Salem around the area that they provide this and don't see the need. I think you'll see opposition from the Oregon Building Officials Association because they're equally concerned about that, and they can share that with you later. But I'd be happy to survey and let you know what we find from the various jurisdictions around the state, both a mix of rural and urban areas, if that's of any value to you.
Follow up, please.
Please.
And in these instances that you're sort of aware of,
mm-hmm.
Are these single buildings, or is this a group of core downtown buildings that they do these kind of things to?
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, I know in Portland, I believe that they've done. Yeah, well, I think that they provide the best example. They've done some pretty remarkable things in core areas up there that I've seen just as a citizen walking around. I assume that other jurisdictions do that as well. So, the provisions in the building code don't limit your ability, as we currently have, to focus on a specific site or a project. There's lots of flexibility.
One more, please.
Yes.
when we talked earlier,
mm-hmm.
You said that you felt that this would be a problem, and that if this code were put in, it would mean that the rest of the state couldn't do this.
Chair Witt, Representative Rod, that's my concern. Right now, the entire state can provide the flexible approach, and I've showed you the laws that allow for that. What I get concerned about, whether it's building codes or any other level of statute, is when another set of statutes kind of go over the top of that, what is the policy direction the legislature is sending? If the state's position this can be done now and you pass a bill that alludes that it can't be, what have I accomplished? What's the message we send to the jurisdictions, and how do those various statutes overlap each other? That's my concern.
One more, please.
Yes.
So is it your testimony today that Hillsborough actually has the ability right now to create a special local code? Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, when we're dealing with existing buildings, and I'll just walk you through this if you'd like. If you start at the first bullet, when you're dealing with a change in occupancy, it's kind of technical, but the last piece, municipality's building official has the discretion to make this determination. That's an existing code right now found in the Oregon Structural Specialty Code. When you are talking about repairs, alterations, and additions to historic buildings, they do not need to meet the provisions of the state building code regulating new construction so long as the work does not make the historic building more dangerous. That's the general policy.
So is that a yes?
Well, it's a qualified yes, Representative Riley, in that you can do, I want to walk you down through this. Municipalities can adopt ordinances to deal with rehabilitation standards for seismic provisions of the state building code. They can do that. That's the yes part. That's the fourth bullet down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the rest of the provisions, they can use the existing building code that we have and apply that don't make it more dangerous standard. And then the third thing that they can do is recognize an existing code as what's called an alternate method of materials under the building code for that particular project or that particular site. So it is a qualified yes. What I don't want to say is that local jurisdictions can indiscriminately adopt codes that would be outside of that general policy framework that's been adopted at the state of Oregon. So that's why I'm hesitating a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Riley.
The last bullet basically gives us the ability to adopt codes and you can see for yourself, are necessary to interpret, harmonize, streamline, adjust, administer, or enforce the state building code when there's a code that does not adequately address a project of unique type or scope. That's the authority that allows us to adopt a vintage code or an existing code or a special code for a variety of projects. We've used it for correctional facilities. We've used it for other unique situations where the national building codes don't provide adequate address of a particular situation.
Representative
Dolan. Yes, Mike, a simple question. In Hillsborough, right now, they want to restore 2x3 blocks to a vintage period. And it's very clear to me after, I know what Hillsborough wants to do. And after talking to you, I'm fairly certain they can do it. But what I'm looking for is Mr. Representative Barnhart's question in the last bill we went. They can do that? Is that correct right now?
Chair Witt, Representative Dellum, yes.
Thank you.
And we'll be happy to help anybody in the state, whether it's Hillsborough or any other jurisdiction. We have a whole regional program with folks out to help people get to yes. That's what my opening comments were.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to sort of go through a series here and then ask you whether that works or not. I'm looking at ORS 455.040, the title of which is State Building Code Preempts Local Ordinances and Rules, Exceptions, Criteria. And then it says, the State Building Code shall be applicable and uniform throughout this state and in all municipalities, and no municipality shall enact or enforce any ordinance, rule, or regulation relating to the same matters encompassed by the State Building Code, but which provides different requirements unless authorized by the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs. And then there's more language, but that if I were not aware of what you had just said and I read that that sentence, I might decide that at that point the municipality did not have the authority to make changes. And then I go back and I look at your bullet number one and your bullet number two, in which you refer to the code itself, in which you've actually, director of the department has actually exercised that authority by writing what some of the specific exceptions to that might be. You're not requiring uniformity in certain areas already under the code as it exists. Now, if I understand it correctly, then applying this statute to these codes, you believe that you're already in the situation in which Hillsborough or any other city could write a code to deal with older buildings that reasonably will not make the older buildings more dangerous. I think that's the restriction you had in here. And that would comply both with ORS 455.040 and the state building codes. Now, have I got it right or I missed it somehow?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, you have it. I'm impressed. Thank you. And you're helping us make our case. Another layer of statute that would confuse that current relationship, that's kind of why I'm here, is to make sure that we don't do that.
Well,
040 is designed for new construction, and you hit it correct. We've adopted codes that provide that flexibility for existing construction, and I think the key piece is, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, is for things that we've addressed at the state. We haven't addressed all situations in construction at the state. Rehabilitation, dangerous buildings, existing buildings, site conditions, those kind of things are left at the local area.
Thank you. So if I could follow up then. What you're saying is that 040 is intended to apply to new construction primarily, and that you allowed some big loopholes for municipalities to write reasonable rules about other things.
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, I'd be happy to kind of give you a quick building codes 101 on the statewide consistency piece, if you so desire.
Well, I think that may be part of what we're here about today. And,
sure.
And I suspect, without knowing, that one of the reasons that Chair Witt decided to hold this hearing is to clarify this issue.
Sure.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay. Well, I'll try to do my best not to make it too awkward or technical. The state code is, if you will, and I'll use analogy, is almost a contract to all contractors in the state that says you get to build to this code, and it's the minimum and maximum standard. And when you work in Portland, or you work in Pendleton, or you work in Phoenix, or you work in Eugene, you have the ability to meet that code. Okay, and a local government can't, I'm talking generally here, can't require you to exceed that and shouldn't go below that, because we want to set a minimum standard so that our citizens are protected. But what we also do is provide for alternate methods, and we provide for flexible approaches in existing buildings. And essentially the way it works is, if I'm the contractor and I go to the local jurisdiction and say, I understand I get to build to the code and that you can't make me exceed that, but I want to try this flexible approach or this alternate method for this particular project or series of projects, the building official has discretion to say yes. The building official cannot, though, go and say, we have this minimum code, we have this statewide code, and you haven't asked me yet, but I want to make you do this other alternate approach. I hope I made that clear. And so that's the intent of the statewide code, and that's where we spend a great deal of our time. It isn't in dealing with problems where somebody's working out a flexible situation with a local billing official. I never get anybody complaining about that. Hey, I wanted to work out this flexible approach, and the billing official's working with me, and we've worked out this alternate method, and we're in agreement, and we're not unnecessarily providing risky codes. I don't get any complaints from contractors on that area. What I get complaints is we've adopted these codes and somebody is trying to exceed it or go a different direction and the customer hasn't even been given a choice to meet that basic code. Then we step in and say, hey, wait a minute. That's kind of the intent of the statewide code. It helps provide consistency and predictability to the building construction community so that they know in Oregon what can be expected from a project-to-project basis. And frankly, just so that you know, we're one of the only states in the nation that has this kind of system. So we're very proud of that. But it also can be misconstrued that the state says, absolutely, there's a one-size-fits-all, and in every situation, a new and existing construction, there's no flexibility. And what I wanted to share with you is that's not how we run our agency. That's not what the intent is. And we've provided direction to local jurisdictions to work with their customers and to allow for this flexible approach. I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, thank you. You have. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I heard you say was the contractor has all the discretion in the world. The city has none.
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, I hope I didn't say that.
I think that's what you said. I heard you say that. I heard you say exactly these words, I believe. If a contractor goes to the city and says, I want to try this alternate method, then the city's allowed to say yes. However, the city cannot go to the builder and say, I'd like you to try this alternate method. I heard you say those words.
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, cannot mandate that to the builder if the state code covers it. If we provided a state standard on that, then the jurisdiction can't go around that. But the customer can come to them and propose an alternate. The building official can accept that if they choose so.
So the builder can propose the alternate method, but the city can't.
Or the designer.
But yeah. The city can't.
The city can work. Chair Witt, Representative Riley, I feel like we have a misunderstanding here because the
I think so.
Yeah, because the city can certainly do that, but if the builder doesn't feel comfortable with that, he gets the right or she gets the right to build to the state code. Okay? And so we have situations where sometimes folks make up a standard or make up an interpretation. There's a lot of people in the system and a lot of different inspectors, and what we're trying to say is they have a right to propose and meet that code all the time. Jurisdictions work and say to a builder or developer, you know, the code requires this, but if you did it this way, that would be acceptable. And the owner goes, yeah, I think that's a great idea. Let me do it that way. Okay. Am I making myself clear?
I think so.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Duran.
I'll have a little different line of questioning here. I know that on this bill you said Section 3 you didn't like, and so I was kind of reading it over. And my question is now, in a vintage or historical building, if they don't meet current, if the state fire marshal says they don't meet current fire codes, i.e. sprinkler systems, are they required to put in sprinkler systems or not? Because I know under current code, maybe I'm wrong, but I think if you go over three floors and you have to have a sprinkler system or something to that effect. So the question is, do you have the latitude to excuse a sprinkler system?
Chair Representative Jarrett, I need to first let you know, and those that you work with me, I'm not a code expert and not technically familiar with the individual codes. Now, that said, the problem with subsection 3, this isn't necessarily about vintage buildings. The broader problem is that the state building code sets the new construction standards for whether you need a sprinkler or not. And we would be concerned that that would change that relationship between what the building official does and what the fire official does. And in talking to the proponents of the bill, I don't think they intended to change the role of who makes the decision, the trigger point of when a sprinkler is required, whether it's the building official or the fire official. I don't think that was the intent. We're worried that that kind of confuses that role. I think I've talked to Representative Riley about that as well.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
That's correct. And I believe that the proponents of the bill would not have a problem with taking that. I believe I'm correct in that.
I think that's right. I don't want to go through. I mean, there are little technical kinds of pieces of this bill that I don't think the proponents intended to create confusion in. Our basic piece is that we believe this can be done now. You can hear from others where it can be done, and we would be concerned that, as drafted, it would send confusing policy direction to all of us. So.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm kind of simplistic in my thinking about these situations, but we got to talking about sprinkler systems a minute ago. Now, if I understood your testimony and the bullet points you put in here, and I'm quoting, so long as the work does not make the historic building more dangerous, that would allow, wouldn't it, for a municipality to say, well, normally if you were building a new building, you'd have to put sprinklers in the building, but because you don't have sprinklers already, we're not going to make the building more dangerous, but we're not going to require you to put sprinklers in it because that doesn't make it more dangerous than it is now.
Sure.
Have I interpreted that language correctly, or have I misunderstood it in some way?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, I think we have it correct. I get a little nervous about quoting code here in dialogue.
Well, I'm simply referring to your testimony.
Yeah, the basic premise of existing buildings, as we have it in our code, is that you can work to provide change of occupancy, you can work to provide alternate methods, and you can work to provide code requirements as long as you don't make it more dangerous than the current situation. So I'd have to talk to a plans examiner or a technical person about when or when not sprinkler system would be used as potentially a trade-off for another requirement, and that would be, again, something that you would talk to the designer and the owner about, saying, okay, maybe if you do this, then there's a different requirement you don't have to. I can't tell you what that would be right now. That's how this system works. It's a series of kind of back and forth that goes on to try to get this building updated to a reasonable level of safety, but you don't have to go all the way. And what I think we have is a problem where folks are sometimes believing that you need to go further than the direction that we've provided.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Maybe a follow-up on that. I can imagine a situation where you had a building that had been used as a store and an office building, and all of a sudden we're converting it to apartments or condominium apartments or something. And at that point, more dangerous is a questionable issue because people are actually sleeping there as compared to being alert and awake because they're working there. It might be considered more dangerous even though you haven't changed the physical structure at all. And you might, I suppose, decide at that point that the sprinkler system was required because of the change of use of the building. Have I captured an idea, or have I missed it again?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, have you captured an idea? But again, there's all different kinds. I don't want this to walk away saying sprinklers would be required.
No.
We had that
situation. No, of course.
But you've captured an idea where that's a potential outcome. I don't know when the sprinkler system is triggered off the top of my head right now. So you wouldn't apply a standard that would be greater than on an existing building that would be for a new building. And what I would do in that situation, if I was the local jurisdiction building official, I would look at the code that's actually referenced in the bill. I would look at the international existing code. I would talk to other folks, and I'd come up with working with the proponents and suggest some alternatives. And as Riley said, as long as they agree to that would be acceptable.
And a follow-up, if I may. And so in effect, this becomes or could become a subject of a negotiation between the person who wants to maintain and renovate a vintage building or set of buildings and the local jurisdiction.
Yes.
Thank you.
And again, we believe there are tools to help jurisdictions accomplish that. And if there's something that we need to do to provide greater clarity under existing authority, we'd be happy to do that. As I said, I talked to an individual over at the historic office, and he said, I understand that the codes allow for this, but sometimes communities and individuals don't provide that flexibility, and so maybe we need to work on some training or education. Maybe I need to change the code so it's more clear we don't have to have this kind of confusion brought to you. I'd be happy to do that. We have the existing authority currently.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Long, for your testimony on this. I think you're doing a good job of clarifying some issues for the committee on this. And it seems to me that the part of your statement is that, you know, our state building codes are designed to protect the public and protect people in general when it comes to safety and those sorts of things. And throughout our state, to each project and in my history, they oftentimes present unique situations that sometimes have to be addressed, even in a specific building, as to, you know, imminent danger and things that are subject to failure that we need to be able to cover in a state policy. And so I'm trying to figure out what the problem is that we're that the city of Hillsborough perhaps, or the proponents of this, other proponents of this bill, are trying to solve. Because it seems like to me what you're explaining is, you know, we have to put some reliance on our building inspectors, who are qualified to look at a individual building and say, you know, you're not increasing the danger, and, you know, we should be able to work with this situation. And I share your concern about making a state policy that may abandon some policies that at the state level that disregard life safety issues and perhaps the uniqueness of an individual project that has a situation that needs to be addressed. So I say that because I think you've presented a case to us that explains that the local building official does need that flexibility to look at a unique situation and be able to make a determination that fits under the purview of the state building codes to make sure that we do have an overall program of safety. As you know, we struggle from jurisdiction to jurisdiction having different codes that mean different things, and I do worry that we deviate from a statewide consistency in what is safety and what is what kind of building codes preserve, you know, a building's integrity. So I guess that's not a question, that's more of a comment, but I don't know if you want to follow up with that.
Well, Chair Witt, Representative Holby, I think what this bill tells me at the state is that what's something that we think we understand, maybe not everybody else understands, and that we need to do a better job of educating and training some of our inspectors, as well as providing information to business owners and economic development districts and whatnot about how they can go about dealing with historic buildings and existing buildings. And I'd be happy to do that. And what I'm here to tell you is we've got all the authority in the world to address that.
Representative Dahl.
One last comment, Mike. After you and I visited, and I visited with Representative Riley, I'm fairly certain that Hillsborough can get their project accomplished. But I want to leave this statement and look up and down the dais and be sure there's agreement. In 2 years, if we come back and Hillsborough is well on their way to restoring their historic district, we will celebrate. If they're not, and it's a code issue, we'll be happy to get into your business and muck around.
Chair Witt, Representative Dahl, are you sure?
we want to run pretty much everything, yeah.
Okay. I'd be happy to get the help, thank you.
Right answer.
A propensity to muck. So. Mr. Long, Building Codes 101 was very helpful. And I think before the hearing is over on House Bill 2540, some of us may be seeking continuing education credit. So thank you very, very much for that that background. It was very, very helpful.
Mr. Chair, if I may, if you would ask him to stay in the room during the hearing, we may have further questions.
Okay. Can you make yourself available,
Mr.
Long?
You bet.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call up Christine Phillips. And Christine, it looks like there's perhaps a panel that you'd like to bring up with you.
Good
good indication. Okay.
Sure.
Good morning to all from the city of Hillsborough.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christine Phillips with Tonkin Torp, here today representing the city of Hillsborough. Joining me this morning are Hillsborough City Councilor Aaron Carlson and Hillsborough Senior Projects Manager Pat Rebellia. House Bill 2540 allows but does not require DCBS to create an alternative building code that would make redevelopment of older downtown buildings easier and more affordable while preserving fire and life safety. We strongly support passage of this legislation and appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning to explain the merits of this effort. I would also like to state for the record that the American Institute of Architects couldn't be here today, but they do support House Bill 2540 and have submitted a statement in writing for your consideration. With that, I will ask Councillor Carlson to give you some background on how this legislation came to be and why it is an important step for Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chair Witt and committee members. I'm Aaron Carlson with the City Council in Hillsborough, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony in support of House Bill 2540 and to respectfully request its passage by your committee and enactment into the Oregon Legislature. On behalf of our downtown Hillsborough Business Owners and Business Association and for the benefit of the older historic downtown core areas throughout the Portland region and city and the state, the City of Hillsborough seeks favorable committee action on 2540. Attachments to my statement summarize the bill's key features and why it's needed to enable rehabilitation of vintage downtown core areas, and a diagram example taken from the North Carolina Rehab Code of what an optional downtown code might look like if this code developing enabling bill is passed. And the staff is here to answer any questions that the committee members may have on these matters. There's a lot of debate, as you just heard, among the proponents and opponents on House Bill 2540 about whether it's actually needed for the rehabilitation of historic and vintage downtown buildings. And with all due respect to the building officials and organizations who say the bill is not needed because existing state building codes already allow flexibility in the application of code provisions to building rehabilitation projects, we must respectfully disagree. At least in our own downtown and probably in many other downtowns in Oregon, building owners, investors, planners, and architects do not know what the provisions are and how to find them, how to interpret them, and whether the buildings would qualify for their application, as the provisions apparently are discretionary. Under these circumstances, their utility for downtown rehabilitation revitalization is extremely limited, if not nil. More importantly, these existing code provisions are applied, if at all, on a discretionary case-by-case basis to individual buildings, connected buildings, or spaces within such buildings. So their utility toward revitalizing older and historic downtowns is very limited. In contrast, what House Bill 2540 seeks to enable but not require is the adoption of a flexible, graduated, optional rehabilitation code that would uniformly be available to all such buildings and spaces within a very small piece of geography that were the downtown core of Oregon towns and cities as of 1950 or earlier. If enacted, House Bill 2540 would become a vital and instrumental tool for revitalization and rehabilitation of these vintage downtown cores throughout Oregon. Supporting testimony for the bill from Metro today will attest to its potential benefit impact of the bill within older downtowns in the Portland region as well as statewide. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt and committee members, for the record, Senior Project Manager Pat Rebellia. And I'd like to start by going over what's in your testimony package, just briefly, so as a background to our testimony. Following the written statement by Councillor Carlson is our testimony from our building official who has a medical appointment this morning and could not make it, but he wanted to get it into the record and to before this committee. And it's, in essence, what it says is there is a need for in a flexible rehab code for older downtown core areas, uniformity, consistency, and basically a framework that can hopefully come from a statewide framework rehab code. Following that is a sort of quick outline of the key features. Following that is a map And what the map shows is within our 22 square mile city, this optional code, again, and I would emphasize that it is optional because it doesn't require the director to draft this code. And in its initial form, before it went to legislative council, it also alternatively sought to enable local building officials to do those things that were that are specified in the bill right now. But apparently in Elsie's judgment that it would be better just to have the director. But my point here is with this, what we're trying to illustrate with this map is that the geography to which this optional code would apply in the state would be very small areas, very vintage small downtown areas. Following that is a diagram, and it looks complicated, but in effect, what it is a one-page sheet that the state of North Carolina has a rehabilitation code. It's not geared and focused only on downtown areas. It's focused on older communities in North Carolina. But as you can see in one page, what it does is it illustrates a graduated sort of rehab code that has flexibility, that applies building code requirements, you know, not in the area of fire and safety because they rely on the uniform code there, but in those other areas of flexibility, it's a graduated system where repairs would have only a few things done. When you move up to an alteration or renovation, a few more things. Changing of use still form a few more things. So it's a graduated scale, and it is. While we're not endorsing the North Carolina concept, what we're endorsing and proposing in the bill, and in Section 2 makes reference to the concept of having that graduated sort of system so that there is not only flexibility but cost considerations, because in our town, and I suspect in many of the older downtowns in Oregon, owners are of limited resources, and if many of them had to, and as is the case in our downtown, if many of them had to fully meet uniform code requirements, it's economically infeasible for them to renovate, to slightly expand, to even change uses. So, following that is some material on the core of our the centerpiece of our downtown. So, in the middle of those four blocks or five blocks that you saw on the map is our town theater. That's the core, that's the centerpiece where we think an enabling legislation like this with a follow-up code will help us, as the materials indicate, breathe life into a downtown core. So for us, and again, I suspect there are other older downtowns in Oregon that have that same sort of centerpieces that are of the same vintage, that something like this would be very helpful to. So that's the materials. Now let me get to sort of, I was asked to sort of get into a little bit of the mechanics of the proposal, so I'll try to do that. The key difference here, and I appreciate Mr. Long's testimony, but the key difference here in this bill, in Section 2, is that what it tries to do is to establish a rehabilitation code that applies to a geographic area, not specific uses, not only specific buildings, but the connected buildings. If you go back to the map, you'll see a series of older buildings along our main street, and many of these older buildings share common walls. Many of these older buildings have old second floors that, for code purposes, are not usable. This code, with this bill, would enable a rehabilitation code for those geographic areas. What it tries to do, it doesn't require the director to do this, but it's enable the director to prepare a code that would apply to the grouping of buildings, the connected of buildings. These would be provisions, flexible rehab provisions that's available to all those buildings, to the spaces in all those buildings, to the owners in all those buildings. What this does is we think, and we hope, this rehab code becomes a tool for revitalization, economic revitalization, economic rehabilitation. And it enables these owners of limited resources to have the ability to, if it's marginal, they could proceed with repairs, renovation, site alterations, to get more use options in these areas. So we look at this enabling bill, code bill, as an essential tool for areas like our downtown geography to get off the ground. And again, we're looking at a geography that is even less than 1% of our 22 square miles. And I fully understand the arguments that in the existing code, on a case-by-case basis, there would be flexibility. But as our counselor indicated, most of our owners don't know what those provisions are in the code, where they are, how to interpret them, you know, and whether they would qualify. And I think Mr. Long made it pretty clear that it is a case-by-case discretionary application. So the existing regime, we think it's very problematic that it can be used as a tool to rehabilitate downtown cores, the vintage downtown cores, because of those that reason. Want to make the point that, again, that we're not this doesn't mandate the preparation of a code. It enables it. It wouldn't apply to new construction. In other words, an owner in a downtown core area would still have the option to do something if he or she had the resources under the new code, the uniform code. That option remains. This doesn't, as the code, as Section 2 really states explicitly, wouldn't apply to new construction. The uniform code would apply to new construction. And it doesn't waive any fire and life safety standards in the uniform code. That's the baseline. And this code was never intended to go below that baseline. In Section 3 of the bill, the earlier discussion was correct. What it talks about is waiver of things beyond a rehabilitation code, a discretionary waiver of things beyond a rehabilitation code. And again, it's discretionary. It's subject to the judgment of the building official or the fire marshal or whoever that code official would be. So I guess I'll stop there and I guess we'll be glad to answer any questions unless Councilor or Chris, you have any other comments.
Thank you very much, committee members. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been listening to all of this, and I'm trying to figure out what code is causing your problem, and what code to address your problems specifically is standing in your way, and I'm just not hearing that. So I'm kind of curious as to where the city of Hillsborough is running into problems with codes that haven't been able to been worked out with their building officials.
Well, again, like Chair Witt and Representative Holby, I like Mr. Long, I'm not a code expert, but I can tell you by illustrating the problem that we have with downtown. There is a building shell that used to be an old penny store in the early 40s, late 50s. It is now an antique shop. It has two floors. The owner runs the antique shop on the bottom. His family and he would like to develop the second floor for his residence, and it can't be done. Now, I don't know which particular code or requirement in the uniform code or whatever applies, but it can't be done. So I'm trying to illustrate by that circumstance there is something apparently in the codes that's preventing this from happening. And I'm sorry if that's an inadequate answer, but that's the only way a non-expert can
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess that doesn't really satisfy me, you know, coming from a construction world myself, and I like to think in construction anything can be done, quite frankly. I've never seen a scenario that engineers and architects can't figure out how to accomplish a particular project, you know,
sure.
frankly. So I guess that doesn't really answer my sure. my question specifically is what code that the city of Hillsboro or this individual has gone to a specific building official with a set of plans and said, how can I do this? Has that happened? I guess that's my where I'm struggling with this whole conversation, because it seems to me that there's a process for accomplishing this already in statute, and I'm not understanding what specifically the problem is in accomplishing this goal, because I have great concern with some parts of this bill and in regards to life safety as well, because it seems to me, well, that's another question. But anyway, I'll let you just address that again, perhaps. I
apologize, but I am not a code expert. But in this particular situation, the owner, I suspect part of it is cost prohibitive. Part of it is structural, reinforcing of the walls, because this building sits between two other buildings with a common wall. So it's probably the cost prohibitiveness is because of the code requirements is making him make that economic decision that he can't proceed and continue to have a viable business there. So again, I apologize, I'm not a code expert, but that's the circumstances that we're finding commonplace, you know, in that, you know, seven or eight blocks that you see in that area.
Yes, sorry to beleaguer this point, perhaps, but I can appreciate the problems of trying to plan something, but unless you have specific, you know, I guess, drawings and engineering proposals that can be examined to address what needs to happen, I guess. You know, because I can imagine there's lots of buildings that were built in the 1950s that you don't want to put any more weight on those walls. It may not be a fire marshal life safety issue, but structurally, which oftentimes a fire marshal, I don't believe, really makes a judgment on that kind of safety. There is, and I don't see that kind of life safety addressed in your bill, but, you know, if that building were to fall down because we just loaded those walls up with so much weight and it just crumbled and killed people, you know, I'm not trying to be facetious here. You know, things like that happen with snow load and things like that. I'm very, very concerned that this bill opens up an opportunity for cities and developers in the interest of, you know, economy is a great thing, but you know, when you're putting, you know, major renovations that need to have some scrutiny, I believe that, you know, you need to work closely with your building officials and your engineers to figure out the solutions to those problems. You know, our codes have been developed over, you know, decades of years by professionals going forward looking at situations like this. So I'm just not sure what's wrong with the current system, and I have great faith in our codes that they're there to really, you know, not to be a barrier, but really to protect the owners and the people that inhabit or visit those buildings. And so I guess I'm just not really hearing how your problem isn't being addressed.
Chair Whitten, Representative, dating back to the Columbus Day storm of 1964, many of the facings on the second floor of those buildings came down from that windstorm, and they worked hard back in the 60s to preserve the brick and the structural integrity after
those winds hurt our town. And we have worked very hard on preserving individual buildings, but we're looking at the big picture, which is where we're having difficulty in working with the building code supervisors to say, how can we make this several block area and work together in common walls without putting any life safety on a back burner. That is our primary goal, is to make sure that our citizens are safe. And the second is to revitalize the downtown so that it is a common. We talk a lot about extra spaces where you want to be, besides your neighborhood, besides your home, but having that third place to go. So I think there's testimony that's attached to mine, along with the photos from our building department, that speaks to, in their second point, to the development of the simple standardized code. We spent many hours on the phone earlier this week in a conference call trying to work through the codes with the State Department. And that was frustrating in that the city had already been through several different lines of communication to say, what code would you suggest with that? And we got a lot of response, I'm not sure, but it's there. And that happened on the phone earlier this week before this committee hearing was called. So we were trying to work through to be able to establish that we could move forward with revitalizing our downtown before having to seek legislation. We've been working on that. And the circles are getting frustrating. We've spent a lot of time, a lot of money trying to revitalize. And the not looking past the safety, that is a primary concern. It's in the bill in that Section 2, Section 3 of 2, that the fire marshal would have that ultimate cross.
Representative, Vice Chair Riley.
Actually, Pat answered my question in response to another question, so I'll pass at this time.
Thank you. Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I guess I'm still sitting here thinking, you know, I don't see any specific, you know, I guess, has there been engineering done on these walls that's been submitted to the city and they said they can't do it? Or and to also follow up on your reference to Section 2, subparagraph 3 about the life safety issue, it's as defined by the state fire marshal. And that's not inclusive enough, I don't believe. I guess I'd need some other code expert perhaps, but my knowledge of it is the state fire marshal doesn't look at all the life safety issues in a building. So, I mean, that's a narrow description of life safety that is not, does not, in my mind, protect the safety of, you know, Oregonians or anybody for that matter.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. First of all, I want to commend you for coming down here. I think your ambitions and what you want to do is real noble, and I think most people on the committee here commend you on the project that you want to do. I think it's just, if I'm trying to figure out how to get you from point A to point B, is what we want to help you with. What I heard before in the testimony was that there's a lot of flexibility in the codes. And actually, what I hear you arguing for is for less flexibility, and it's supposed to be a set of codes for each project. And I would kind of venture to say that even within from building to building, there probably needs to be that flexibility in order to make it more cost reasonable for you. Now, when I was here in 93, what really is music to my ears in your testimony is that we're starting to realize that historical buildings, we need to have quite a bit of flexibility with historical buildings. When I was here in 93, City of Albany put a lot more restrictions on their historical buildings, which made it really difficult to improve historical buildings, and what people were doing was doing demolition instead of improving the building. And so there was a bill that came out in 93 that gave people the ability to opt out of historical zones so that they could do it in a more cost-reasonable method. So mine isn't a question either. I just want to commend you for being here. I think your heart's in the right place, and please don't interpret our feelings about the bill as any means whatsoever as trying to say that we don't support the redevelopment of the community, because I don't think there's anybody here that doesn't want that to go through. And we had the person from codes saying that there is flexibility in the codes on a case-by-case basis. So, and on the Penny's example, I've done a little bit of development. And two things usually get in the way from having a commercial building not being able to develop the second floor into a residential. And the first, ironically, usually is city zoning laws. The second one is usually a state fire marshal. So that would be my guess where the problems lie.
Thank you, Representative Gerard. And I think that you've probably spoken for much of the committee here, that we are very favorably impressed with all the economic development that your city has undertaken. In fact, have been an example for much of this region in terms of the projects that you've carried out. I think all of us have probably also, at one time or another, experienced the frustration of those circles that you have described, and sometimes it's enough to literally drive us to tearing our hair out. And one thing that we might suggest today, with the presence of Mr. Long, that he might be able to help straighten out those circles, maybe a little straighter path here to the desired results that that you're seeking.
If I may, Chair Whitten, committee members, and thank you for those remarks. And we were listening to Mr. Long's testimony. We were very pleased to hear that under the current regime and code, that in fact local building officials will have the same, and again he can come up if we're misunderstanding this remark, but will have the same ability like Portland has to adopt by ordinance a flexible code that will help us address the issues that we're trying to address through this bill as well. Thank you.
With both of your presence being here, you may have some one-on-one consultation here today. Thank you, panel, very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. And as Representative Gerard has pointed out, appreciate your very good efforts at rehabilitation and economic development. Thank you so much. I'd like to call up now Randy Tucker from Metro, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Good morning to all of you as well. For the record, Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2540. Let me just explain briefly Metro's interest in this legislation. The voters of the Metro, of the Portland region, in enacting Metro's charter, have charged the Metro Council with managing the region's growth and development in a way that creates great communities and supports the quality of life of our region, both today and in the future. And following a tremendous amount of public input 12 years ago, in 1995, the Council, in order to achieve that objective, adopted the 2040 growth concept. The map that's behind the testimony that the members have received, and anyone that in the audience that would like a map, I can email one to you or show you one on the web, is a map of the concept that was adopted and which still guides the Metro Council's efforts to promote quality development in the Portland region. A key element of that plan is the development of about 40 downtowns and regional and town centers. The regional centers are the medium-sized sort of purple circles on the map. There are seven of them on the Oregon side of the Columbia River. And there are about 30 or so of the small purple circles that are known as town centers. And by the way, the back of the map is just bonus. It's something that many of you have seen. It's just legislative districts overlaid with Metro Council districts. It's just I hand this thing out free, liberally. So, at any rate, you can see that Hillsborough, Gresham, Oregon City, you know, et cetera, have been designated as regional centers. And the benefits of developing centers include more efficient use of our limited supply of land, protection of farmland on the edges of the region from development if we're successful in intensifying development in these centers, greater transportation choices and transit access, better air quality, vibrant communities, higher property values, and the list goes on. In the decades since the Council adopted this 2040 growth concept, the region has experienced some success in developing in these centers, but not enough. And we've learned that the tools we have at our disposal, which essentially are the urban growth boundary and a very limited amount of transportation money that we distribute as the Metropolitan Planning Organization of the region, are important, but they are not sufficient in order to obtain the kind of development in these centers that the region is seeking to achieve. And Metro, along with its local government partners right now, is engaged in a pretty ambitious project called the New Look at Regional Choices that you'll hear more about over time, depending on what committee you sit on, that is an effort to develop new tools to implement this long-range plan. Basically, the tools have to do with the urban growth boundary, which you wouldn't hear about in this committee, and with investment, you know, additional investment tools. But we also have some you know, a whole list of less grandiose ideas that are on that we're trying to add to the toolbox, and the bill that before you today would be one of those kinds of tools that would provide greater flexibility for the kind of development in these downtowns that the region is seeking to achieve. So I think I'm in good company today by saying I'm not a building codes expert. I've heard that from several people now, including Mr. Long, and so I'm not either. In general, the Metro Council supports the direction of this bill, and the objectives of this legislation can be achieved in another way, we would support that as well. My suspicion, having heard Representative Dallum's comment about what might happen 2 years from now, is that somehow this is going to get solved. In closing, let me just quote Representative Dallum again, who said, we want to run everything, and I'm just pleased to hear that there's somebody besides Metro that's being accused of wanting to run everything.
Oh, that's good.
Because we don't want to run everything. I'd be happy to answer any questions to the extent that I can, but I'm here generally in support of the concept and the effort to provide greater flexibility for this kind of downtown redevelopment.
Thank you very much, Randy, very much. Questions for Mr. Tucker, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard in the middle of your testimony one of the good things that you want to come out is a development with greater ability to use the mass transit.
That's correct.
And I'd like to point out to the committee that light rail runs along the south side of this particular square. That's the MAX line, and there are two stops that touch this blue line.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, yes, there's just for the rest of the committee, there's a lot of development that's going on in downtown Hillsborough that Mr. Rebellia and others can, and Councillor Carlson can certainly speak to a lot better than I can, that is directly related to the presence of that transit line, directly or indirectly. And you know, there's a lot of good stuff happening in Hillsborough right now, and we'd just like to see, you know, them have the ability to do more good stuff.
Fantastic. Representative Gerard.
I'm still a little bit confused because the bill actually asks for kind of from region to region a set of various codes, but those codes then would be kind of a written in stone, whereas we have testimony that in older buildings, there's a lot of flexibility in codes. Now, when I did stuff for my own, I redid an old house. The riser out of the toilet was a 4-inch riser. Well, they don't make them anymore. So, I mean, it's not standardized. And so there'd be some flexibility saying, right. Look, you're going to use a 4-inch riser. So it seems to me like you're arguing for the wrong direction here. I'm trying to get the policy switch here because I would think you'd want more flexibility instead of greater constraints, and that I'm a republic of flexibility is good. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I think we are saying the same thing. I'm not going to be the guy that can talk to you about the specifics of the bill, and I suspect that if this bill is going anywhere, it's going to change some anyway. And so, what I think Hillsborough is asking for, and what certainly I think we're asking for, is greater flexibility to do things that they believe they can't do right now in order to achieve their downtown redevelopment objectives when you've got older buildings where the standard building codes may not be appropriate. And so I think, we'll have to have a much more detailed conversation about the language of the bill, and it seems like there's a definite disconnect having sat through this hearing and listened to the testimony, so I think we have to, resolve that. But I think I'm on the same page with you, I think.
just to follow up on that, historical preservation that went through in the 90s, that put a lot of constraints in, and I'm not so sure that that's not where some of the policy questions lie is with the old, I think it was ballot measure 5, or it had to do with land use, with historical preservation set-asides.
7, maybe?
7?
I'm not sure.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think that might be, and the reason I say that is when I was here, the city of Albany came in here and was arguing the opposite.
Right.
And so then some of us stood up against the city of Albany. So that's why, actually what they're saying, the city of Hillsborough, I mean, that's music to my ears because that's what we were arguing back then. But, I do think we're on the same page. And maybe we can get there with amendments and we're just going in the wrong direction here.
I agree.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad you recognize that Portland Metro seems to be trying to run everything. So,
I believe I said the opposite, Mr. Chair. I just said we're accused of trying to run everything. You better jump in before that gets too far.
Well, I guess I'm still actually a little bit confused and conflicted about, the testimony in support of this bill. And your testimony doesn't seem to really be talking about the building codes that are addressed in House Bill 2540. And I understand your testimony, but I'm wondering what specific building codes has Portland Metro not been able to work with to renovate their district, their vintage districts, I guess.
To be clear, Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, Metro doesn't deal with the building codes at all. The cities do. And so it's the city of Hillsborough that I think, needs to be able to give you a specific answer to your question, and hopefully they'll do that after the hearing later on. As I said, I'm not the guy that can tell you which code needs to be fixed, and I'm speaking in general support of the effort to provide more flexibility where it's needed in order to achieve the objectives of the region and the city in redeveloping old buildings.
Thank you, and I appreciate your general support of that. I support that as well, but my problem is that the flexibility you're describing, I believe, already exists in the codes, and mm-hmm. and this particular bill is addressing specifically building codes, and does some things in this bill that I think are need to really be taken a second look at. I just don't see the problem that you're. I mean, I don't see the problem in House Bill 2540 in relationship to your testimony. I don't see the connection between the two. I support your general statement, but I don't think that it's exhibited by supporting House Bill 2540. Actually, I think just the opposite. So I gotta say, I think this, I want the problem fixed that the city of Hillsborough is having, perhaps in trying to come up with a scenario that works for revitalizing their downtown. But I don't think House Bill 2540 addresses that. I think it causes me some great concern about where we go with building codes in this state. And because I think the codes and local building officials have the expertise to accomplish these scenarios, and unless there's just a life safety issue in the structure, perhaps, that's going to cost a lot of money to fix. And, you know, at that point, you have to make a judgment on whether that investment is worth it, I suppose, because we certainly don't want to start jeopardizing people's lives in the name of economic development. And so, you know, I appreciate your statements, but I don't think that your support of House Bill 2540 is really demonstrated in your testimony, specifically about the building codes. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I agree with basically what you're saying, and I think there's going to be, you know, just my assessment of what's going on in this hearing is that there's going to be further discussion about the language of this bill and whether there's a way, you know, how to achieve the objectives in it. So I don't have any argument with you about that. I think, we'll have to take a look and see how we can get things to work the way Hillsborough would like them to work.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. Representative Dahlem.
No, I think Representative Holvey has done an excellent job of asking my questions.
With that, not seeing any further questions, Randy, thank you so very, very
much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And a good job with the economic development, too. Next, I'd like to call forward Wade, is it Yanni? Uni, excuse me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Again, I'm Wade Uni. I'm a practicing structural engineer. I'm a principal at DCI Engineers in Portland, and I represent the Structural Engineers of Oregon. I'm against this bill, and have some comments to make along those lines. I've worked for 25 years as a structural engineer in Portland. I specialize in existing buildings. My goal when I deal with an existing building is to preserve and save them. That's why I like doing it. I'm involved in the ASCE, which is the American Society of Civil Engineers, which is a large engineering organization. That is, and I'm on a committee that is responsible for developing standards for existing buildings. We actually finished balloting ASC 41, which will be available this month. It's been in the works for 10 years, and it will be available for anyone to purchase this month, and this building or this standard is designed to be a guide for upgrading existing buildings. And you were asking questions about codes. Well, there's actually quite a void for codes for existing buildings, and this standard is a kind of a benchmark for this type of standard. In fact, the city of Portland will probably adopt this standard, if not the end of this year, next year. As a state, I would expect a uniform approach to existing buildings. That right now, it's city by city. There are voids in the interpretation of the codes. Like we've heard earlier, Portland has a great existing building standard. It's called Title 2485, and I was involved in developing that. But like, for example, the city of St. Helens has no standards, and basically you can do anything to a building in St. Helens, but in the city of Portland you have very strict standards on what you can do with an existing building. The approach that this house build has, the not make it worse, is extremely dangerous. There are so many buildings that I walk through on a weekly basis that are basically time bombs waiting for the big one to strike. We don't want to be the next New Orleans. We don't want to have a big earthquake and have all of our buildings in shambles. And this allowing redevelopment of existing buildings without any regard to seismic upgrade is ridiculous. The state, or the core triggers for dealing with an existing building, and this is out of several existing building documents and basically the core of the City of Portland's Title 2485. There's three triggers for upgrading an existing building. The first one is if you change an occupancy, and Representative Barnhart had a good example of the warehouse to residential. I like the worst one is a warehouse to a nightclub, where basically you have a building that has no standards for a high occupancy load. And if you allowed a developer to turn a warehouse into a nightclub and have over 300 people for an event, you would have a huge increase in potential danger to those, you know, patrons. So change of occupancy is number one. And then the next one is additions. If you have an existing building and you allow someone to add like a second floor to it, the original floor probably doesn't have the capability to support the addition, and that's a certain trigger to require seismic improvements. And then the third one is a major renovation or modification to the structural system. For example, cutting holes in shear walls, weakening the structure would require an upgrade. As a state, we need to improve the stock of our buildings and get ready for the big one. And the easiest way to do it is on a program directly linked to the remodel and rehabilitation of these buildings. The testimony that you heard earlier, they keep citing that you can't do this. I do it every day. That's my job, is to try to figure out great approaches for making these buildings safer without making them prohibitively expensive. So it can be done. The best time to improve the building is during a remodel, so it makes sense to not endorse this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Dolan.
Yes, could you explain to me, and I'm going to go to the Beaverton example that was used, the Penny store, and the upstairs converted to a living quarter.
That's Hillsborough.
Hillsborough. Pardon me. What did
you said? Beaverton.
Thank you. Oh, Hillsborough. In deference to Representative Roddy, Hillsborough. How does the process work? I know in building a couple of homes in various places in the state, I'm very familiar with that. But Somebody wants to add a story. Do they take the drawings to the county? Where do we get to the rub point where somebody says, I have concerns about the structural integrity of this, or I have concerns about the safety of this building in case of fire? When does that happen in this process, and where are we missing it here?
Well, use the example that I had, City of Portland versus the City of St. Helens, okay, a large metropolitan area and a small town. In the City of Portland, there's a planned series of steps that happen to assure that that building is upgraded properly, but in the City of St. Helens, where they don't have a specific Title 2485 like they have in Portland, it's basically the discretion of the person behind the desk and his, the plan examiner or whoever checks the plans for compliance. So it's person in a smaller community has no guidelines or no book to go to see if all these safety issues are being addressed. In fact, you could probably do the conversion that they were talking about in Hillsboro in certain communities in the state right now without any involvement of a structural engineer at all. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, and then, so the point that, and I want to be crystal clear on this, if Hillsboro wants to adopt a set of standards, that's a local option, and that's where we would see to it that touch point was made, is in the community itself.
That is true, because the City of Portland's Title 2485 has, is perfectly legal in the state of Oregon, and any city has that potential to adopt the standard like that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Rowley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this Title 2485 is Portland's built renovation standard.
It's their code for existing buildings.
Their code for existing buildings. And so you're saying that any city in the state has the ability to, on their own discretion, do a something like Title 2485 and create their own standard? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm a little confused. I think I understand why you say you oppose this bill. I think the essence of the bill, if we don't read the details, but we look at sort of what the general argument of it is that it encourages the state to adopt a code that would apply to existing buildings. I mean, that's obviously not what it says. But that's part of the argument, I think, in favor of the bill. What would your view be of the state, for example, adopting ASC 41?
Oh, I think it's essential that they do.
Okay, and you believe that the department already has the authority necessary to do that?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm trying to remember what question I was going to ask you now. Mm-hmm. Mr. Uni, if a building owner who owns a building with a common wall with another owner decides that they want to do a rehab, an upgrade, or whatever, and that remodeling effort might necessitate or warrant a seismic upgrade,
We're sharing a common wall, and the structural integrity of that common wall is in question. And we have an owner on one side of that wall who wants to do something, and an owner on the other side of the wall who's a little reticent to do that. How do we deal with that kind of situation?
Man, that's a good one. And I've run into two projects like that in the last couple of years. And when we rewrite the Title 2485, I'm going to make sure that we have that included. But it's very confusing when you have a shared wall agreement, and generally the person that doesn't have a wall, in other words, there's going to be a property line,
mm-hmm.
and someone owns the wall, right? And the guy that doesn't have the wall is responsible in an upgrade or something like that to provide his own wall. It's like buying a car without tires. You know, if you don't have tires, you got to go buy some. So the guy that, whichever building doesn't have the wall is really responsible for getting his own wall. That's the way I interpret it. It's not written down in any code, but it's a good question.
And I suspect, as Representative Holvey said earlier, good engineers and good construction workers can do anything, so maybe one owner could buttress his or her side of the wall to make that feasible.
Yes.
Okay. All right. With that, Mr. Uni, thank you so very, very much. Appreciate your testimony this morning. I'd like to call forward now, please, Stuart Ramsing. Mr. Ramsing, we only have 10 minutes left, and you're one of the last two people, so if you could manage your time accordingly, we'd be very appreciative.
I will keep it brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Stuart Ramsing. I am the building official for the City of Eugene, so although I'm not the plans reviewer and inspector in the field, I'm perhaps closer to that than some of our previous speakers. So if you have questions about the specific authorities, I'd be happy to answer those. Briefly, I'm representing Oregon Building Officials Association, and OBOA represents cities and jurisdictions across the state of Oregon, representing most of the building officials in this state. And OBOA, we encourage you to oppose 2540. The bill, if you've heard, encourages BCD to adopt a new building code. It's for the vintage downtown districts, utilizing those HUD standards. You've also heard that authority to use alternative standards currently exists. And we have that, and we not only have that authority now, we exercise that authority regularly. We exercise that. I personally oversee that in Eugene. I know it's exercised up and down the valley and throughout the state. This bill creates complexity and new regulations where we really need the simplicity and the flexibility that we have right now. And I think Representative Holvey has stated clearly a few times, I'm unclear as well, what is the problem? And we're unclear on what the problem for the reason for this bill is, and the OBOA Legislative Committee has spent quite some effort working on this, and I've personally had some conversations with the building official of Hillsborough, Jerry McKee, and when I had those discussions some time ago, he and I had an understanding that flexibility existed, and he raised no questions about the authority as the building official for the city of Hillsborough to exercise that administrative judgment. So I remain at a loss to what the problem is that we're trying to fix here. There are some number of technical faults in the bill that I won't point out right now, but would need to be identified if things were to move ahead. But let me point out some of the concerns that I'd like to elevate to your attention. First, the state fire marshal through this bill is tasked with identifying life safety items. Sounds appealing on the surface, but the codes have developed over the years, going back to 1927 when some of the first uniform building codes were created, and the building codes have generally been under the purview of the building official. There's a separate fire code that's under the purview of the fire marshal. And so items we refer to generally as life safety exiting fire sprinkler systems, even not their continued function, but their where they're required in their installation and design. Those fall under the building code, so it's concerning to have a state fire marshal tasked with something for which they're not expert in. Again, let me emphasize that we do have the authority. It exists currently. Local jurisdictions already have the ability to approve alternates to traditional code compliance and to allow modifications. That's the wording of the code. What we call it on the street is a waiver. We have that authority right now as building officials, and we can apply that and do apply that to existing buildings. That's where it's completely appropriate. The code doesn't always fit an existing situation. That's where you'll see it more than others. There are many standards out there. HUD's developed one standard. There are many others, and this bill encourages the use of the HUD standard, which suggests then that it precludes the use of other standards, and that would be of a concern. We just heard from an engineer who's identified yet another standard that seems very targeted for structural concerns, and we'd like to leave those options open. And there's also a concern that we're really talking about historic buildings here. It's curious to me that it's couched in the terms of a vintage downtown. So we've identified a downtown, and you've got one building that was built in the 40s on one side of that line and another building built in the 40s on the other side of that line, and they would have different codes. There would be two different codes in the state of Oregon if this bill went ahead as intended. That's concerning. And simply because what is the difference between those two buildings? We have that authority to be flexible with the issues that are unique to those buildings right now. The other technical fault in the code would not apply to a building that's built new and hasn't been occupied. But in many communities, there would be a downtown that could be identified as having existed in the 1950s that may have buildings built in 2002 occupied, and when they're remodeled, apparently they would be held to the vintage code. And so that's a technical flaw. I think that could be fixed. Finally, the State Building Codes Division, Mark Long's office, in partnership with Oregon Building Officials Association, is working continuously. We have in the past, and we are right now, on reviewing codes for existing buildings. The International Existing Building Code is a document that exists. The state of Oregon is looking at that with building officials, and we have those documents that we're polishing and making available to jurisdictions. So it's in this regard that we oppose 2540 and have concerns about it. We do believe that it has the potential to eliminate the flexibility that we need. It's simply not necessary. Can't identify the problem, and frankly, I'm not hearing as a building official, I speak personally, I'm not hearing from developers that there is a need for another code in the state of Oregon. So I can certainly clarify my comments, and I can perhaps speak to some of the technical questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramsing. Vice Chair Riley, briefly, please.
As a OBOA, is that?
Oregon Building Officials Association.
As a member of that association, I'm assuming that you would be available for consultation with his city of Hillsborough to help them through this problem?
In fact, I thought, yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
And I thought we had that, and that's why I'm at a loss.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramsing, and Vice Chair Riley expressed my sentiment as well, and we appreciate your offer of help, and should this bill move forward, we would like to be able to rely on your expertise in drafting some amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call forward Sean Miller, please. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. And, although I've been working on building code issues for the last 13 years, I will say that I'm not a building codes expert as well. However, I want to commend the city of Hillsborough bringing an issue like this forward to resolve an issue that they may have. However, I just question it within the house, this particular house bill. I know in my contractors having different issues on local government interpretations of building codes or resolving those kind of issues. If I were to introduce bills on every one of those issues, I'd probably have to introduce about 150 bills this session. However, what I've done is, and very successfully, is work with Mark Long at the Building Codes Division. Last session, or I think, believe the session before, he created a local
regional approach too, to kind of resolve these kind of issues. Every time there's been an issue like this come up, I know from my experience they've essentially satisfied a problem and have fixed a problem. On House Bill 2540, I think Representative Holvey said it well, that if you're a contractor in these situations, you're going to be able to use that flexibility and to accomplish your goals. I'll use one example from a contractor I've known for several years, Pacific Crest Construction, who was involved in renovating all the McMenamins in the state of Oregon. And essentially, the McMenamin brothers, if you've ever walked into one of those taverns, have prided themselves in taking probably the oldest of old buildings and turning them into pretty amazing projects. And so that particular contractor needed that flexibility, obviously, to accomplish, I think, what you see when you walk in there and have a beer. And so I'd encourage the existing flexibility within the building code, and I will be the first one to say that I want the city of Hillsborough to accomplish what they want to do, because as representing contractors, I want them to be able to build those projects. And so I'm not here to say that this is the best or the best way to approach it. I want to support them in their efforts in any way they can to accomplish that. I just question it within this particular House bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. And I think you've summed up the feelings of probably our entire committee. Brief questions or
final
comments?
Final comment.
Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
As you look at the map of the downtown Hillsborough that was provided, I live about 10 blocks from there. And I would like to invite anyone who would like to come out and see what Hillsborough is doing, which is very good work in rehabilitating downtown. We've got some great things going. We want to do more. And I'd invite you to come out and take a look, and I'd be happy to show you around, as I'm sure the councilor would. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Riley. Again, like to commend the city of Hillsborough, as Vice Chair Riley has just pointed out, for your exceptional efforts in economic development. If nothing else today, we have heard the two sides of one coin of sustainability, our society's needs to move forward on rehabilitation and economic development in our core downtown areas. We've also heard from a number of folks who are very passionate about the public safety and health. And for that, we're very grateful for both sides making sure that our state moves forward in a sustainable manner in every instance in economic development. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2540. And Ellen, if you would give us a brief summary of what we're going to be covering on Monday.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. On Monday, March 5th, beginning at 8 a.m., we will have our first public hearing on House Bill 2643, which creates a tax relief commission in the Economic and Community Development Department. We will also have an informational meeting presented by the AARP and Portland Community College on three recent studies that they conducted on workforce development.
Thank you very much. Anything more before our committee today? Not seeing anything. We stand adjourned until Monday morning. Thank you all very much.